assets. Imaginary Landscape No. 1 by John Cage, one of the earliest electroacoustic works ever composed, written in 1939. Welcome to Late Junction with me, Anna Hilda Nesset. No composer has been a more influential figure on contemporary musical thought than John Cage. For the next three nights, Late Junction will be a part of Radio 3's celebration of Cage, who would have been 100 years old this month. We'll be listening to Cage compositions as well as works by artists he inspired. Imaginary Landscape No. 1, composed for piano, a large Chinese cymbal and two turntables, was one of the first pieces to employ a record player. The piece made a big impact, especially within the development of electronic music. Here is John Cage writing in 1937, 2 years earlier. "I believe that the use of noise to make music will continue and increase until we reach a music produced through the aid of electrical instruments, which will make available for musical purposes any and all sounds that can be heard."
Thank you.
Years ago, I worked in a music shop called Rough Trade in Covent Garden, and there, Richard James, aka Aphex Twin, sometimes used to come in, pick out a bunch of music like John Cage and David Tudor and maybe some musique concrète to listen to. And on this album that we just heard, called Drucks, he decided to explore Cage's sound world by preparing his own piano according to Cage's principles. And squeezed between those two Aphex Twin tracks was Sonata No. 9, played by Cedric Pescher from Cage's Sonatas and Interludes from the late 40s. 600 recordings are necessary to make the next piece we're going to hear, Williams Mix. It's Cage's first composition made for tape, and the sounds are in six categories. There's city sounds, country sounds, electronic sounds, manually produced sounds, wind-produced sounds, and the last category is small sounds, which need to be amplified. Pitch, timbre and loudness are notated here as well, and it's all composed using the I Ching. This is from a live recording from 1958 in New York's Town Hall. Listen out for the audience reaction at the end.
What a terrible...
Mixed reaction there in 1958 for John Cage's Williams mix. And helping Cage make this piece, our studio engineers, was Louis and Bebby Baron, more famous for their landmark electronic soundtrack Forbidden Planet. They were primarily known as studio engineers, and though they got a lot of praise for Forbidden Planet, they couldn't be given the Academy Award because they were not part of the Composers' Union. And it was Cage who first encouraged the Barons to consider their creations music. We're going to hear an extract from the Forbidden Planet soundtrack. This is Love at the Swimming Hole.
Thank you. Ha ha ha.
Solo for voice number 11 for electroacoustic voice. It's part of John Cage's Songbooks, which is a collection of 90 solos for voice that Cage composed in 1970. And as a theme, he took a line from his diaries that reads, "We connect Satie with Thoreau." And here, Thoreau, of course, is Henry David Thoreau, the American transcendentalist, thinker and writer. Songbooks is a new CD on the label Sub Rosa featuring Laura Lixenberg, Gregory Rose, both of them vocalists, and BBC Radio 3's own Robert Warby on electronics. John Cage was an excellent communicator who rarely turned down interviews. He even turned up on TV several times in competitions and chat shows. But here, John Cage talks to the BBC's Michael Oliver in 1980 and explains why he became a composer.
I didn't know when I was very young whether I would be a musician or a painter or a writer. And actually, I'm very fortunate because through music and through the fact that not everyone understood my music, it became necessary for me to write. And then in the course of making music, the magnetic tape recording became of such high fidelity that one could make music on tape. And then it became clear that space and time had a certain equivalence, so that much of my notation became graphic. And that led people interested in visual arts to invite me to make etchings. So that where early I made a decision in favor of music, music has been generous and brought me back to all the things that interested me.
You said you made a decision and chose music. Mm-hmm. What was it that caused that decision rather than the possible decision?
I, before that, found myself in an architect's studio in Paris. I was very young. I had heard him speaking to someone, a friend, and he said, to be an architect, you must devote your life to architecture. And the moment I heard him say that, I knew that I was in the wrong place, because at that very time that I was working in his studio, I was interested in music and painting and poetry. And so I went to him and I said, I can't work with you any longer, because I refuse to dedicate my life to architecture. But then I think it was less than 3 years after that, when I presented myself, having studied with Adolf Weiss, I wanted to study with Schoenberg. And when I went to him, asked him to teach me, he said, you probably can't afford my price. And I said, don't mention it, because I don't have any money. And he said, will you devote your life to music? And I unhesitatingly said yes.
Another thing you're quoted as having said is that you don't have a strong harmonic sense.
No, I don't. Harmony, you see, is not itself a sound. It's a connection between sounds, and that connection doesn't exist in sounds themselves, though the theory books all say that it does. But the pitches of our music now aren't related to the overtone theories, which the theory books say that it are. Our fifths aren't perfect. I imagine that our octaves even are sometimes, and our unisons are probably imperfect too. But certainly the fifths aren't. And this was brought about through the desire to modulate from one key to another. Harmony is a theory. And what I would like is to have sounds be free of that theory. And when I didn't yet know that, and thought that I should study harmony, since to be a musician you should study harmony, counterpoint, etc., orchestration, I could learn the rules, but I had no facility. I had no feeling. And from Schoenberg's point of view, he said that I wouldn't be able to compose music. This was after having taught me for 2 years. And I said, why not? And he said, not having a feeling for harmony, you'll come to a wall that you won't be able to get through. But then he was forgetting that I had promised him to devote my life to music. And so I said, well, then I'll simply have to spend my life beating my head against that wall. I was devoted to Schoenberg, and I still am. Were he alive, I would honor him as I did earlier. And I think if we could converse together now, that he would not consider that I'd been unfaithful to his teaching.
He did say you weren't a composer.
Yes. But then one's notion of what composition is could change, or certainly he didn't have such a closed mind, really. So that's why I say if we had the opportunity to converse, I might be able to persuade him that I was faithful to him and that my work was, in a sense, composition. I think of myself as a composer. And the reason I think that Schoenberg might agree now, if we converse together, is that when I was studying with him, he sent us to the blackboard with a problem in counterpoint, even though the class was a class in harmony. And he said, when you have a solution, turn around and let me see it. And I turned around and showed him this solution. And he said, that's right, now another solution of the same problem. And I gave him that. And so on, until I'd given, I think, 7 or 8 solutions. And he then said, and I had always worshipped the man, but now he seemed to me to ascend in my estimation. He said, what is the principle underlying all of the solutions? And I couldn't answer him then. But in recent years, say within the last 5 to 10 years, I came to the thought that the principle underlying all of the solutions is the question we ask. And it is important, not only in music, I think, but in the rest of our life, that we ask important questions so that we get good answers.
But he is owned as teacher and master by those who want to control every single aspect of their composition. Whereas you abandon that control.
Not always, but often. I do abandon it even when I write a composition out in every detail, as I am doing now with the Freeman Etudes for violin solo. I don't control it, but I make it very precise through the use of chance operations. I think that my work shows different instances of how to proceed non-intentionally.
Where did you get the initial idea of proceeding non-intentionally from? Hitherto, I mean, up until you, really, the idea of any creative artist was, I wish to create a finite, complete, whole, graspable thing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I felt myself at a crossroads in the late 40s. It was a result of many things concurring. One was an actual experience of going into the anechoic chamber at Harvard University. I expected to hear no sound at all because it was a room made as silent as possible. But in that room, I heard 2 sounds. And I was so surprised that I went to the engineer in charge when I left the room and said, there's something wrong. There are 2 sounds in that room. And he said, describe them, and I did. One was high and one was low. And he said the high one was my nervous system in operation and the low one was my blood circulating. So I realized that I was making music unintentionally, continuously. So I felt myself to be, as I say, at a crossroads where I could proceed as my body was proceeding, unintentionally, or I could continue intentionally. But since everyone else was doing that, it seemed more reasonable and more useful to the society if I took this other direction, which I did.
Is that where Thoreau came in?
He came in later. The story I'm telling you just now comes in the late 40s. And my serious contact with Thoreau, I had read him when I was younger, of course, in school, comes in the late 60s. The language of Thoreau is, I like it very much, in the same way that I like the music of Erik Satie. You know in French those terms about music. Debussy was enrichi, whereas Satie was dépouillé, the feathers pulled out. And I think if you look at the early writing of Thoreau and then at the later writing, that you see the adverbs and adjectives disappearing. Mm. And the language gets, well, as he said, simplify. Chance still enters into all the spaces. I think Thoreau was aware of this. He said that besides what we think we're doing in a day, we have also to prepare the food, or to get the food and to prepare a meal. And in the doing of those everyday things, so many things happen by chance. There's so many things to see, so many things to hear, and so forth, that, as Thoreau says, we don't need any further entertainment than that.
So you would say that you are not actually going out and deliberately subjecting yourself to chance. You are accepting that chance is an important element.
Right. I only use chance operations as a discipline when I'm making something. I don't think of my life as something being made, but rather a series of experiences. But if I'm making a text, or if I'm making a piece of music, or if I'm making an etching, for instance, then I have recourse to chance operations in order to free the work that I'm doing from my memory, my taste, my likes and dislikes. I chose those chance operations and I use them in correspondence to sitting cross-legged and going through special breathing exercises, which one would follow such disciplines if we were going inward. But as a musician, I'm necessarily going outward. And so I use this other discipline.
Now you say you free yourself of memory, taste, mm-hmm. and so on. What do you free yourself for? What are you opening yourself up to?
The rest of the world, don't you think? I hope so.
I agree, but a large number of people do find it difficult to imagine a creative artist abandoning, they would say, his role as a creator.
Not abandoning it, simply changing it from the responsibility of making choices to the responsibility of asking questions. And I do ask the questions, and I try to ask radical questions. I mean to say questions that get at the roots of things. If I succeed in asking radical questions, then the answers, even though they come through chance operations, will be, I believe, revelatory in the sense of revealing to me more of creation than staying with my mind the way it was would have revealed. Who was it said that? It was Erik Satie, said that experience is a form of paralysis, because we get absolutely stuck with our ideas. Through chance operations and faithfulness to them, we can get free of that paralysis.
But it does demand from the perceiver an absolute openness and a willingness to go along with this.
That demand on the observer or listener is made by anything. Any other art, too, don't you think?
Not only art. I mean, what I think I'm coming round to is that if one accepts what you have been doing in, at any rate, your most recent work, then it isn't confined to music or even to the arts, that it is a social thing.
And becomes useful in everyday life. if you become open to the world outside of your ideas about it, I mean to say really attentive to the world outside of you, which you can perceive through your eyes and through your ears primarily, then you become a Thoreau unto yourself. The pavement that you're standing on can become fascinating. The way the light falls on two different Coca-Cola bottles can be fascinating, etc. So that we come to a poetic awareness of the uniqueness of each experience, of the necessity to have the experience at the moment that it presents itself, because it's constantly changing.
Make the voice sound like telegraph wires, says the score to the piece we just heard. It's Cage's solo for voice number 17 from his songbooks that we heard earlier. And here, the recording of Wires is by Australian sound artist Alan Lamb. Before that, we heard Chris Watson, Sir David Attenborough's master sound recordist, here with his majestic recording of the River Mara in Kenya. As Thoreau stated, if you pay attention to the world, you need no other entertainment. You're listening to Late Junction with me, Anna Hilda Nesset. We're celebrating John Cage's 100th anniversary this week, and you can check the Radio 3 website for more details about the music you're hearing. Here is a piece called Experiences No. 2 by Cage, using a text by E.E. Cummings and sung by none other than Robert Wyatt.
It is at moments after I have dreamed of the rare entertainment of your eyes, when being fooled to fancy I have deemed with your peculiar mouth my heart made wise. It is at moments after I have dreamed of the rare entertainment of your eyes, at moments when the glassy darkness holds the genuine apparition of your smile. Silence molds such strangeness as was mine a little while. Moments when my once more illustrious arms are filled with fascination. Moments when my breast wears the intolerant brightness of your charms. One pierced moment whiter than the rest, one pierced moment whiter than the rest.
George, if you've dipper tops in your head, your silence that hencolleges ex-smooth ostbies for ost boys, each and one death banes and the quick quoke. He conjured himself the theatron, gigantogyres with free-flaw forms, as of young a palatine white-lock lacked, just to roly-holy over Svapnus Vap, of all the stranger things that tomb, dyke, and hollow entireties of lives living, the muskiosca gin palast, the bathhouse and the bazaar has his stay, and all a dreams perhaps sing under Lux Loop at last all doze. Why, such me, the Roper Jerks, Jake Vampus, Fella Eilish, Jerk Wobblish, the man what gave me the keys to dreamland, sneakers in the grass, tick off that Kaffler's head, by jings, with the great just Harry of chest hamps and affectionate company, real devotes, ugly judsies, what choose is left to yearns, nor you your ruck sunk hike round the lodge of Fjorn Gala, tamming Uncle Tim's cowbean, as on the night of the apophenipes, jumps to shoots to throps into me mouth like us two only. I was but teen, a pining child, round sluppery table. I'm sure he squirted juice in his eyes to make them flash for flightening me. Still and all, he was awful fond to me. Just a whisk of pity, a cloud in peace and silence.
Joe Heaney singing Cage's Roratorio, an Irish Circus on Finnegan's Wake, Part 4. And before that, Experiences No. 2, sung by Robert Wyatt, which was actually released by Brian Eno's Obscure label back in 1976. When asked about who he would study with were he an aspiring young composer today, John Cage answered James Tenney. The next piece by Tenney is made at the legendary Bell Labs. It's called Ergodos 1 for John Cage, and for the mathematically minded, ergodicity means the probability that in any system, any state will recur again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Summer from The Seasons, performed by the American Composers Orchestra, conducted by Dennis Russell Davis. The Seasons is a ballet cage made for choreography by his friend Merce Cunningham, first performed in 1947, and he said of the ballet that he tried to imitate nature in her manner of operation. And that's a line of thinking he developed with his string quartet, which we'll hear tomorrow. But tonight we're going to end with singer and Velvet Underground founding member John Cale. He made a sound installation tribute to Cage called Call Waiting. But before then, Cage's beautiful In the Landscape, composed for dancer and choreographer Lewis Lippold, performed here by Margaret Leng Tan. You've been listening to a Late Junction Cage special, and we'll be back tomorrow night with more John Cage as part of the Radio 3 centenary celebrations. Good night.
Hello and welcome from me, Jonathan Swain. This is Through the Night here on BBC Radio 3, and a recent concert from Geneva to set us on our way tonight. The Suisse Romande Orchestra, under the Swiss composer-conductor and oboist Heinz Holliger, and Holliger the Piper later on in pieces by Leclerc and Recher. The concert closes with Mozart's Symphony No. 40, and it opens with the Petite Symphonie by Gounod. It's from 1885, with Gounod responding to a request for a piece from his friend, the virtuoso flautist Paul Taffanel, and Gounod scored it for pairs of oboes, clarinets, horns and bassoons, but a single flute, presumably so Taffanel didn't have to share the spotlight.
Thank you. Thank you.